I have a friend who, when I've introduced this friend, I've always said this sort of thing, because most of you say you are not prejudiced people. And you, if I say I have a friend, you'd say I'd like to meet them, if they're your friend. And you could handle any friend I could lay on you, in terms of weirdness. Well, my friend Emmanuel hasn't got a body. See, and a lot of people say, well, I don't know about that. You know, I mean, see, well, he's my friend. I mean, it's not your problem, but I don't know whether you have imaginary playmates, but I do. I have lots of them. They enrich my life immensely. And Emmanuel has a great sense of humor. He's absolutely delightful. You remember that when I asked Emmanuel, say, Emmanuel, I work with people that are dying. What should I tell them? He said, tell them it's absolutely safe. I mean, who wouldn't love somebody like that? He said, it's like taking off a tight shoe. Dying is like taking off a tight shoe. Because where he's looking, he did it already, and he's sitting around, you know, he knows. And he's saying, what are you making such a big deal out of the body? It's just an incarnation, no big deal. Well, what happened was that I had gotten, throughout those years, I was busy sort of putting down my physical body and my personality. I was so neurotic, and my body was not quite what I wanted it to be, and I just figured, I'm going to get out of this. I'm going to get high. And then at one point I said to Emmanuel, Emmanuel, what is my work? What should I be doing on earth? And he said, Ram Dass, why don't you, you're in a school, why don't you try taking the curriculum? He said, why don't you try being human? You know, I'd never thought of that. Because as far as I was concerned, my job was to push away my humanity and to get high. And I'd get high in any way I knew, and then I'd see it all, and I'd be wise and far out. And then I'd go back to my room, and I'd come back into my humanity. And I'd yick. And so I realized that until I didn't take an incarnation by error. In fact, there are no errors in the game at all. Not any errors in form at all. All form is lawful. It's all lawful. There's no errors. And what's far out is as long as you identify with that part of you that is in form, you are merely a lawful happening. You can talk free will, but it's nonsense. That's not free will. That's all lawful unfolding. When you decided to come here tonight, that thought didn't just come out of the void. It comes out of this, which led to this, which led to that, which led to that. All your thoughts, your body, this is a 1931 model that is decaying in a perfectly lawful and orderly fashion. And as long as I identify with all of this, I am merely lawfully unfolding. And Emmanuel said to me, you have your choice. Do you want to be the victim or the creator? Because as long as you are the incarnation only, you are the victim. You are being had by the law. And you feel yourself caught in stuff that's just happening to you. You didn't ask for it. If you think you are the form. Ah, but if you flip into these other levels of consciousness outside of form and met yourself behind form, which isn't describable, you can't say I am a that because that's a form. It's very frustrating because you can point at it, but you can't describe it because every description isn't what it is. But as you begin to acknowledge that part of you that is not in form, and even to rest in it, you begin to experience what it feels like to be that which created yourself. Then there's only one of it, and it creates. It is creation by its very nature. You could call it God, or you could call it creation, and you're it. And standing nowhere means you are both the creator and the created. You are both the creator and the victim. And you stretch to be able to handle that incredible paradox. And you watch your own drama unfolding, and you are both in it, if you're accepting your humanity and taking the curriculum, as Emmanuel suggests, and you're not in it. That part of you that is not in it appreciates the perfection of the way it's unfolding. Now you say, perfection? Hey, man, look at the homeless. Look at the suffering. Look at the terrorism. Look at the bomb. Look at my stomach. Look at. You're going to call that perfection? You out of your mind? This guy, what a Pollyanna-ish guy he is. There's another paradox. The paradox is when you stand back and you look at the forms of the universe, you see law. And you see the law of karma, it's called, or whatever you want to call it. That's one way of calling it. The law of the unfolding of cause and effect, in which everything is related to everything else in the universe. Every blade of grass bending is related to everything else. And you stand back and you are awed by it, and you look and you see your body and your personality and your history and your family is all part of it. And you appreciate the perfection of the unfolding of it all, including the suffering. But if you just do that, which you do up here with your third eye, your heart, which is your emotional heart, your human heart, says, what kind of an insensitive, callous person are you? Because if you're only up here, somebody trips in front of you, you say, karma. But if you're just down here, you look around and the suffering stinks, and you try to do something about it, but it is so immense, the amount of suffering, that you go to fill the dike there and it's leaking there, and you go to fill it there and it's leaking there. And where are you going to do it? What are you going to do it? You're on the good guy mailing list just like I am, you know. Which one do you write your check to? You know, is it the whales this week? Is it the battered women? Is it the... On and on it goes. Nicaraguans, Guatemalan refugees, who is it? There's the paradox. The paradox is that suffering is part of the plan of it all, and suffering stinks. And as a human being, you do what you can to end suffering because of the compassionate nature of your heart. At the same moment, you know that it's perfect, including your wanting to get rid of it. Can you hear that? It's a far-out relationship, and it's important because if you don't have that balance and you try to help people, you will burn out. There's no doubt about it. Because you can't do it. You can't do enough. Every time you go to do this one, that one. I've been working with people that are dying for some years now. And I must tell you that while I wouldn't lay suffering on anybody, I have sat with people that are suffering incredibly with various kinds of cancer and other kinds of physical conditions. And I will tell you that I have watched people with egos that are like cinder blocks. They're so heavy and thick and busy with themselves, and their self-pity and their anger and their And I've watched the suffering eat away and eat away and eat away and eat away. And then I've watched, it's like the shell cracks. And it's like the spirit is born. And I see them often very close to death, and they're like great, wise, spiritual beings. And I didn't think there was a chance of a snowball in hell that person was ever going to come up for air spiritually in this lifetime. And the suffering was what did it, and yet I would never lay the suffering on them. The interesting question is, who did? And the answer, as Emmanuel points out, and that feels very valid to me intuitively, is that the suffering I'm having, I laid on myself. I am the creator and I am the created. I designed my game and now I'm living it out. Now the question is, when I'm living it out, do I forget that I designed it? Say that, you rat. See? Then another part of you says, yes. I want to complain. All right. It's an incredible dialogue, and it's a dialogue inside ourselves. And what stretching is required to embrace that incredible paradox. Once you appreciate that there is freedom, and that you have tasted the possibility of freedom, you may try to forget it, but you can't, as you've all found out, I suspect. And it haunts you and compels you. And at first, what you do is you try to get free in off moments, because the rest of the time you're busy living life. See? But maybe on a Saturday night or maybe Sunday morning at church, you'll go in to get free for an hour. Okay, I've got an hour between, you know, I don't want to screw up business on Monday morning, but Sunday I'll go in and get free. But then you start to get greedy for the freedom. I mean, if there's one addiction that outlasts all the others, it's the addiction to be free. It's the addiction to come up for air, to live in the light, to live with love, to be spacious, to be present, to be ah. Because you can see that it can be fun, but you're not having it. And you feel screwed. And why should you be screwed? I mean, it's just a shift of your head you got to go through. So you get greedy. So you start to look for the methods. And you try to, you fit them in, take more time to do it. See? When I went to my guru in India and I said to him, Maharaji, how do I get free? He said, feed people. I said, feed people? I mean, you don't expect you go all the way to the Himalayas, you know, and you sit at the feet of the guru and you expect him to say, come into this cave and I will give you the word, and you know, and you will sit quietly and then you will go through and you'll be free. He says, feed people. So I tried a different tack. Maharaji, how do you get enlightened? He says, serve people. Well, I heard him say it, but I figured, you know, what does he know? He's just considering me kind of low life, you know. I mean, he's not taking me seriously as a spiritual seeker, because the serious guys meditate. You understand? I mean, the schlock people serve, but the serious guys meditate. That was my model. So I figured I'll show him, I'll meditate. And it's been bizarre. I mean, for years I've been meditating. This summer, for example, I spent 2 months in Rangoon, Burma, meditating. In a meditation center where there are 800 people, there were six of us Westerners. Everybody meditates from 3 in the morning until 11 at night, every day. And what do? You follow the muscle rising in your abdomen with each breath. And once a day, you go to visit the teacher, the Sayadaw. And he is like an exquisite doctor of the mind. He knows, he's been listening to minds for 35 years. He knows every little slimy game your mind can play. So you go in and you give your report. You say, I was sitting in meditation at 6 p.m. last night, and I was following the rising and falling of my breath. I was noting the rising, noting the falling as falling. After about 2.5 minutes, I heard the sound of a bird. I noted it as listening. And he'll interrupt and say, Did you hear the sound of the bird on a rising breath or a falling breath? I didn't notice. Try to do better in the future. And then as you're leaving, he throws in little curves like, did you go to sleep last night on a falling breath or a rising breath? And there's nowhere to hide because you're under a vow of truth. I mean, you can't even phony it because why would you do that? Who loses? And he sees, he knows. And you get so subtle. I mean, you get 2 months of that. You don't talk to anybody. You don't look at anybody. You're just following your breath. And when you're not following your breath, you're doing walking meditation, which is lift, move, place. Lift, move, place. Lift, move, place. Lift, move, place. Lift, move. It's about 15 seconds. Now, consider doing it from 3 in the morning till 11 at night. I mean, it really does clean out a lot of the stuff in your mind. You get to see how much you hate doing the method and how you wish you hadn't been such gung-ho guy to get yourself into that scene in the first place. But it looks good on paper. I mean, he was in Rangoon for 2 months meditating. You know, he was with the heavy-duty guys. So this is a really good thing. You get merit, it's called. Merit. Brownie points. You do go into extraordinary states. You get so that the breath gets so focused that all the thoughts that rise up of who you were or who you will be or that you're sitting in Rangoon or anything just become like they're little bugs floating around the periphery of your consciousness, and there's just the rising and falling. And you get so peaceful in that. I would sit in tranquility states for 10 and 11 hours without moving. I think, could this be? But that was just another thought. But it's just the tranquility state. It's no big deal. That plus 90 cents gets you on the bus. I mean, it's not a big thing. Well, I was going along, and the first month I was plotting how to get out of there. By the middle of the second month, I was resigned to stay through for the 3 months. By the end of the second month, it was starting to get interesting. And at this point, a telegram arrived. And the telegram said that my stepmother had cancer and was going to be operated on. Now, she takes care of my father, who's 87 and very frail. And so it was clear that this was a shock. She was much younger, and this was something I should attend to. So I took the telegram to my teacher. He had it read by a translator, and he said, don't go. I said, I'm going home. He said, don't go. I said, don't go? He said, if you were a Burmese, I wouldn't let you go. He said, you're very high. You're doing wonderful work on yourself. You're really going to get free of suffering if you continue your practice. If you go back now to help out this little bit of suffering, somebody else can take care of it. In the meantime, you're going to lose the gains you've made. I heard what he was saying. It was all clear. I saw my sanskaras or sankaras or whichever way you want to say it, whatever language. I saw the stuff of my family ties. I saw that I was a Jewish boy from Boston with a family and the Jewish tradition of family. And I saw that I hadn't done Shiva. You know, I hadn't died to my family. I was alive to them. And this was my part to play. This was my dharma. It was my way. And I looked at him and I said, I hear what you're saying and I have to go. And he looked at me with compassion. And I came home, and it was wonderful that I came home. I was in intensive care wards, and I've been there for the family, and it's just been superb. And I began to hear, as I got that telegram, and even before, as I was sitting in meditation, I heard, your way, your lineage has to do, your name, Ram Dass, which means servant of God, which is part of the lineage of the Hindu monkey Hanuman. That has to do with service. And what Maharaji was saying to me is, your route through is service. You can meditate. It'll quiet your mind. It'll deepen your awareness and appreciation. And it's wonderful. Meditation's very useful, he used to say. But my primary route was going to be service. So what I've been trying to figure out since I've known that for some years is, how could service be a method? I mean, how do you not get sucked in by service? And a couple of years ago, I stopped lecturing and I just hung out at my house in Boston taking care of my father. I wasn't full-time doing that. I was just part-time, but I was sort of helping do that. And there were many days each week when I would wake him up, take him to the bathroom, bathe him, toilet him, dress him, feed him, hang out with him. These were extraordinary periods for me, because in my mind somewhere was the idea of, how is this an upaya or a spiritual method? I went through so many. What I did was I kept a diary of what it felt like to do this each day, to see if I could see through the veils that were created. First of all, the relationship between my father and I has changed so much over the years. We never touched each other when we were young. Now, I hold him, I massage him, I dress him. When I'm putting on his socks, he pats me on the back. And my heart just opens. So beautiful. Before, we were always busy doing stuff together. Let's do photography, or let's go here, or do that, or do something. Now we just sit and hold hands. I say, Dad, do you want television? Nope. You want music? Nope. You comfortable? Yep. And we just sit there, and every now and then he looks over and he smiles at me. And it's so sweet. We're there together in the silence. When he's walking to the kitchen on his walker, and he's shuffling along, I'm going behind him, lift, push, place, lift, push, place. And we're doing walking meditation together. It's incredible.